Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly for Remember, Remember, the 5th of November. On this week's show, experimental psychologist Steven Pinker tells us how our use of language reflects our inner and outermost thoughts. Also in the show, we ask the bioethicist Janet Radcliffe-Richards whether you can ever take the science out of the abortion debate. We discuss snake oil and pseudoscience with Andy Lewis, the founder of the Quackometer website. Plus, endangered tigers, elephants on acid, and the truth about organic foods. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Welcome, welcome to another half hour of fireworks and explosions. Here to provide gunpowder, treason and plots to proceedings, the Guardian science reporters James Randerson and Ian Sample.
Hello.
Hello. You're not going to like that, Catherine, really.
Only at the end. Only at the end, James. Andy Lewis from the Quackometer website's here as well.
Hi, Andy.
Hi there, Alok.
We'll talk to you a bit later. And finally, Science Weekly producer Ben Green, who's staying quiet. We start this week, though, with Steven Pinker, unquestionably one of the great science communicators, and it's the science of communication that most fascinates him. The Harvard psychology professor has written extensively about our use of language, and in his latest book, The Stuff of Thought, he outlines how the words we use tell us about the way we think. Now, one of the juicier areas of the book is his discussion of swear words. He argues that expletives derive from five main categories. They are sex, excretion, death, infirmity, or disfavored groups. And he told me why. There's some strong language coming up.
Each one of the categories from which we draw our taboo words involves negative emotion. In the case of sexual swearing, it's the revulsion at sexual depravity, and just in general, the high emotion that surrounds sexuality, even in the most liberated cultures. In the case of disfavored groups, say taboo terms for ethnic and racial minorities, it's hatred and contempt of other peoples. In the case of religious swearing, it's awe and fear of the power of deities. In the case of death and disease, it's dread of infirmity and death. So in each case, there's a strong negative emotion. And I think the essence of swearing is the power to trigger a negative thought in the mind of your listener through the use of words. Now, why would we want to do it? Well, there are a number of different ways in which people swear. Sometimes we do it in order to remind people of how awful the objects or activities are. If we want people to not think about how terrible feces are, we use the word feces. If we want to remind them of how disgusting it is, we use the word shit. Likewise, if you're talking about sex in a positive context, you'd be likely to use the word make love. But if you talk about someone who's exploiting someone else, you might say, oh, he's fucking a secretary. And the word is deliberately used to highlight that which is most offensive about the activity. But we also use it cathartically. You hit your thumb with a hammer and you start blurting out words having to do with theology or excretion or sexuality.
Well, of course, I would say that the actual meanings of swear words seem to get lost in the expression, I guess. I mean, is it the emotional content that we're latching onto at that point?
That's all that's left, pretty much. That is when we, if you yell, stub your toe and you yell out, oh shit, it has nothing to do with feces, other than the fact that feces are unpleasant and stubbing your toe is unpleasant. And you ordinarily inhibit yourself from saying shit. And there's probably a reflex, which I suspect we inherited from all the other mammals, where if you're suddenly injured, you erupt in a loud vocalization, presumably originally evolved to startle or intimidate an attacker, but that involves removing all inhibitions and an overflow of nervous activity into the parts of the brain associated with negative emotion, which in the case of humans involves these taboo words.
But why swear words, though? I mean, there could be all sorts of things that make you have huge negative emotions. I don't know, musical, for example, if you hated it. And you might sort of say, instead of saying, oh, shit, or something, you might end up saying something like, oh, Phantom of the Opera, or something like that, because you hate that so much. I mean, but we don't do that. We use these particular words, which are kind of taboo and rude all
and
the time.
And conventional. That is, they're shared across the community. Mm. And it is true that you have to learn what swear words to use with which misfortune. Mm. So even though in In English, the word whore is rather unpleasant, and the word cunt is highly offensive and taboo. When you stub your toe, you don't yell out, oh cunt, or oh whore, though you do in other languages. In French and Portuguese, for example, you yell out puta or con. So you're right that there is a conventional aspect, and that suggests that swearing, as well as being a residue of this reflex, this rage circuit reflex, also has a communicative function, that the swear words that you pick advertise to a real or sometimes virtual audience of bystanders that you're currently in the throes of some extremely unpleasant emotion.
I suppose it's communication. If you said something that they don't understand, they wouldn't get why you're angry or upset.
Exactly right. Yeah. And in that regard, swearing overlaps with other exclamations in the language, like, you know, brr if you're cold, or aha, or mmm, or yuck, which also have no syntax. You just blurt them out as individual words, but they still convey a particular emotion.
That was the magnificent Steven Pinker. You can hear more of that interview where we discuss his theory of the language instinct, the science of malapropism, and the evolution of English as this week's Science Extra. Steven's book, The Stuff of Thought, Language into the Window of Human Nature, is out now.
Hi folks, this is Brian May. You're listening to Science Weekly on Guardian Unlimited.
Let's stick with the subjects of language and communication. Of all the feedback we get sent by you guys in Podland, your main gripe concerns pseudoscience and the gobbledygook companies tout to us as they launch their latest miracle product. Well, with us in the studio this week is Andy Lewis, founder of the website Quackometer, a, quote, experiment to see if it's easy to spot a quack website just from the language they use. Do you want to tell us where you got the idea for this from, how you got involved in the whole sort of bad science thing?
Well, I was spending a lot of time lurking around Ben Goldacre's bad science website, and there were a lot of discussions going on there about how language was thoroughly misused by quack websites, by pseudoscientists and so on. There seems to be an almost universal delight in using scientific language, but not really any respect for science itself. So someone trying to sell something to cure you of a migraine or something like that might bring in concepts of magnetism, of vibrations, of quantum theory and so on. And these things have really got nothing to do with whether or not it's going to cure you or not.
And this just plays on the fact that no one's going to check this stuff.
Absolutely. No one understands magnets or quantum theory. It just sounds very scientific, so there must be something in it, mustn't there? It's appropriation of physics terms, really, in the health environment. Now, of course, physics does have a role in healthcare, usually in diagnostic healthcare, not in, you know, unless it's radiotherapy or something like that, normally you're looking at physics for imaging. So if you're looking at physics words involved in curing something, then that's a good clue for a start. So I thought, well, maybe you can actually write a little bit of web code, if you like, to examine a website, spot these words, see if the website's about health, and then if it is, you can be pretty certain there's something there that's a little bit quacky, shall we say.
This is done automatically, is it?
Yep. You type in the URL of a website that you suspect to be full of quackery, and then the quackometer goes away and looks at that website and starts counting words. And I've got some dictionaries, words like vibration and energy and quantum and things like that. So it counts all those sort of words, and then it counts all other words to do with health, like well-being and so on. And if the two seem to correlate, then it's probably something a little bit dodgy going on there.
But you could also pick up, like, I don't know, the Imperial College physics website with those words, and they're certainly not quacks.
It's obviously not quite as simple as that. If you at The Guardian, for example, are writing, say, Ben Goldacre is writing about something, then obviously I don't want to call Ben a quack. And so I've got to look for words as well that denote scepticism about quackery as well. So you might look for words like, can I swear as much as Steven Pinker here?
You can swear more, please do.
So you might look for words like bollocks, for example, or something like that, which denotes that someone's, you know, really trying to disprove whatever the quackery is.
So give us an example of what's in the top 10 of the quackometer right now.
Well, people can go there and type in all sorts of websites, and I keep a tally of what people are looking at, so sort of hour by hour it's always changing. But I had a quick look just now before we started, and we've got all sorts of interesting things. We've got someone trying to, a very flashy looking website that looks as if magnets are curing migraines. Now, this might well be true. You know, wouldn't it be lovely if strapping magnets to your head can stop headaches? But I think the science there might not be proven yet.
Might not be proven at all.
Yeah.
Give us some more examples from your list or some of your favourite quack websites.
Well, it's not all sort of your high street quacks, really. Sometimes big businesses get involved. And I think one of my favourites recently was Clarins, the billion-dollar French cosmetics company, who came up with this facial mist that you can spray on your face, and it protects you against the dangers of electromagnetic radiation.
I do worry about electromagnetic radiation.
Yeah, especially in this room with all these microphones and things. I feel like spraying some on my face right now. You know, there's no evidence whatsoever that spraying water in it, a bit of seaweed perhaps, can do this.
They were censored by the Advertising Standards Authority, weren't they?
Yeah, some cheeky little monkey complained to the ASA about them, and they got slapped quite... No, it wasn't. I deny everything.
Good on them.
Yeah.
But the website itself is you know, doing very well. But you got into trouble recently as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult area.
Always a good sign.
Yeah, I was poking a few people, mainly homeopaths, and I was getting quite upset, and I think my language might have been a little bit angry, which I think prompted them. Homeopathy is quite good fun, really. People love playing around with sugar pills and so on, and, you know, it's all pretty harmless stuff on the whole, but... What I notice about homeopaths is that they don't really seem to have too many boundaries about what they do. So it's great when you're trying to cure the odd headache or bumps and bruises and things like that. But so many homeopaths seem to be involved in trying to cure dangerous diseases like AIDS and malaria and so on. And seem to have no real self-awareness of this might be not the right thing to do. The Society of Homeopaths, who claim to regulate these people, don't seem to be doing too much about it, and indeed seem to be almost promoting it by holding conferences on AIDS and homeopathy and so on.
What did they do to your website?
Well, they didn't write to me, they didn't say anything to me, but they wrote to my website hosting provider and said, we're not happy, the lawyers did anyway, please take down these articles that we're very upset about. Unfortunately, my hosting provider took them down, well, told me to take them down anyway. What was quite obvious that the internet doesn't like this sort of thing. And within hours, all sorts of people around the world had spotted something was amiss and had copied this article, taken it from the Google cache and reposted it. So within a couple of days, there were nearly 100 duplicates of this article.
And so it just went straight to the top of Google.
Yeah, absolutely. It's completely self-defeating for the homeopaths here, really.
There's lots of this stuff going on. There's a bit of a community building up, isn't there?
Yeah, indeed. All sorts of people from all sorts of walks of life, young students to esteemed scientists who are FRSs and so on, all emailing each other and blogging and talking and having some fun, really.
And it's nice to know that this stuff is all being done sort of together, and you can actually, if you've got an idea, you can post it up on one of these blogs and it'll get distributed. I mean, is there any sense that it's going to come together at some point?
Well, this is what we're looking at the moment, in that we want to try and aggregate lots of blogs together so people can go to one website and see what the best writing is at the moment about bad science type issues. And so hopefully within the next few weeks that will be up and running with the help of Ben Goldacre and a few technical whiz kids.
We'll look out for that, but thanks for now, Andy. And remember, you can investigate any potential instances of new scientific boswellocks at quackometer.net. I'm Alok Jha. You're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come...
A 20 to 24-week-old fetus could not possibly survive outside the womb without a great deal of technological help. But why should the question of what technology can do be relevant to the question of whether an abortion should be allowed?
Can you take the science out of the abortion debate? We ask bioethicist Janet Radcliffe-Richards for her thoughts. Plus, you asked for it and we got it. A biology song from Science Weekly troubadour Johnny Berliner. First, though, it's the science and tech news that's been making headlines over the past 7 days.
News. A new light-activated cancer therapy that destroys tumours while leaving healthy tissues untouched has been demonstrated for the first time by a team of British scientists. The treatment was used to cure ovarian tumours in mice. The researchers believe that the technique could be effective against a wide variety of human cancers, including lung, prostate, bladder, and eye tumours.
Conservationists in the Indonesian jungle have found evidence of several endangered species, including the Sumatran tiger and sun bear, living in areas given over to timber and oil palm plantations. The team from the Zoological Society of London has warned that the habitats for these rare animals could be destroyed by the plantations and have called on the local authorities to reconsider the way they allocate land for agricultural use.
Some organic foods may be more nutritious than non-organic produce. That's according to a £12 million investigation by researchers at Newcastle University. Much organic fruit and veg contains up to 40% more antioxidants than non-organic varieties. Even larger differences were found in milk, with organic varieties containing more than 60% more antioxidants and healthy fatty acids.
And finally, scientists in Cleveland, Ohio, have created a real-life Speedy Gonzales by genetically engineering a mouse which can easily outrun its natural cousins. When let loose on the laboratory treadmill, the mouse ran for up to 6 hours and covering 6 kilometers without stopping. Normal mice gave up after covering just 200 meters at the same speed.
James, Ian, thank you both for those. Let's pick up on a couple of those things. Organic foods. Andy, let me bring you straight in on this. This is a vexed debate. Organic farmers often claim that their foods are more nutritious and that they're better for you than conventionally farmed, pesticide-ridden things. What's your take on all of this?
I think they're worrying about the wrong things, really, the organic farmers or the organic movement, in that they're looking at sort of surrogates, really. So instead of worrying about health, they're worrying about pesticides. And instead of worrying about safety, they're worrying about GM. There's a lot of debate in the organic movement at the moment about stopping air food miles or whatever they call it. But again, they're not looking at the totality of the problem. So things like strawberries grown in Kenya in natural sunlight might be better for the environment than strawberries grown in heated greenhouses in the UK, for example.
Well, this study did look at the sort of nutritional value of foods. Ian, do you want to take us through what it was talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that this was early results from this this study, which I think it's going to be about 12 months before the full report is put together, and I'm kind of feeling that we should pretty much wait for this big report to come out, because
the organic lobby have jumped on it.
Absolutely, and you know, obviously the evidence that these foods are wildly different nutritionally is completely not founded well yet. The other thing is, if there are any changes, any differences in the constituents of these foods, are they actually of any health significance? And I don't think anybody has done any decent studies to look at that. Do you live longer if you eat organic potatoes against something else? Who knows? I don't think anyone's done that study.
Andy, I mean, if you're going to be rationalist about all of these things, I mean, you want to keep an open mind about organic foods. And I mean, it feels right, surely, that you know, a potato that hasn't had all sorts of strange chemicals dumped all over it is probably going to be better for you. I mean, you can understand why people believe that.
Well, yeah, it sounds right, doesn't it? But that doesn't mean it is right. By spraying pesticides on a potato, you might require half the land to grow a crop than one without it. And so is that better for the environment or isn't it? You know, these are real questions that need to be asked.
James. Also, it's just worth noting that, I mean, you know, the organic regime does allow certain chemicals to be put on crops like copper sulfate.
Exactly, yes.
And so it's slightly simplistic to say it's either nasty chemicals or no chemicals at all. Plus, it's also worth noting that the Food Standards Agency, in their assessment of all the results that are out there on the question, specifically the question of nutrition, say that there is no difference.
Well, let's leave that one there for a second. Ian, what's the point of this mighty mouse? I mean, it's got a great video. There's a great video up on our website showing it racing a sort of less mighty mouse, but the other mouse sort of flies off the back of this treadmill in comedy fashion. But what's the point of this thing?
I mean, okay, so what the point of it is, these guys were looking into the effect of a particular enzyme. It's normally a liver and kidney enzyme. They wanted to see what happened if you boosted its activity in skeletal muscles. And they got these amazing results. And, you know, you have behavioral changes. These things were aggressive. Interestingly enough, it was mostly a female effect, which hasn't really come out very well. They live longer, could reproduce for longer, and obviously run like crazy. You know, we are in the middle or at the beginning of an obesity epidemic, which is driving diabetes, which is driving cancer. If you can do a genetic tweak that then, you know, produces an animal that can eat shed loads, remains fit and healthy, lives longer, and all the rest of it, then interesting biology to find out what's going on there. I mean, we're not talking about genetically modifying humans, but it's interesting stuff.
Okay, and whilst we're on the weird animals thing, elephants on acid. You wrote the story. This is a New Scientist story.
And, absolutely. Let's not take the credit.
Let's give the credit where it's due. And they listed a few of the crazier experiments from science.
Yeah, they had their sort of 10 most bizarre experiments going on. And one of them was this, well, I don't know how to describe it really, but the facts are that a director of a zoo loaded up his gun and fired a shot of LSD at their elephant, Tusco. With 3,000 times the dose that a human might take, the poor thing just went crazy. I mean, trumpeting, charging
around.
What
does an elephant sort of have a bad trip over? What is it? Bees?
Yeah, well, they sort of post hoc, they said that they wanted to do this to try and see if the drug would induce this bizarre state that is sometimes seen naturally in elephants, where they produce this weird goo and they go a bit mad. really hard to believe that. I think they were curious and they shot it with a stack of the stuff. Well, it trumpeted a lot, killed over and died.
We've mentioned this on the podcast before. It has been established that that elephants are afraid of bees. And there's also a video of that on the website to look out for. So maybe they're scared of that. But Ben, what does an elephant on acid sound like?
Well, whatever your view, don't forget to add your thoughts to any of these topics at the science blog, blogs.guardian.co.uk/science. The debate over the science, ethics and even the bureaucracy involved in a woman getting an abortion in the UK has continued over the past week. The findings of the Science and Tech Committee have been severely criticised by politicians and medical experts, and the issue will now be discussed by MPs in the next parliamentary session, which opens tomorrow. James, you've been particularly interested in this. Take us through a couple of the main strands of the debate and remind us what the SciTech Committee came up with.
Well, what they tried to do here was they tried to say this is a highly charged ethical, political, moral debate, and so what we want to do is extract just those questions that can be looked at scientifically with evidence. And so that was specifically in their terms of reference, that's what they asked for from people submitting evidence to the inquiry. Now, this annoyed very much a lot of the people, particularly on the sort of pro-life spectrum of the debate, because they said that's ridiculous. This is a debate about morals and ethics, and you can't extract out the science. And so a lot of them started off their submissions by saying we sort of reject the entire premise of this inquiry. But the sort of issues that they were looking at were the current time limit for abortion, which is by and large 24 weeks in normal circumstances. And they were looking at this question of viability. Are fetuses that are born younger than that able to survive and have a sort of normal life or not? And there was, much very, very heated debate on the committee and amongst the experts about whether that's the case. They also looked into other questions like, do we really need two doctors' signatures, which is a legacy of the 1967 Act, or is that simply causing a delay in when women can have an abortion? Should nurses be allowed to do abortions? Those kind of questions. Now, what came out of this was a fairly liberalising set of conclusions from the committee, but at the same time, two Conservative MPs who are both more on the side of the debate for restricting access to abortion, Nadine Dorries and Bob Spink, came out with a minority report that largely rejected the conclusions and basically made lots of other recommendations. So the whole issue, to be honest, and what came out of it is a bit of a mess. But I spoke to Janet Radcliffe Richards, who is a friend of the pod, been on before, and asked her whether you can really ever take the science out of this debate and look at it separately.
The interesting question is what's going on behind this, because the question about viability is now a question of what's technologically possible. A 20 to 24-week-old fetus could not possibly survive outside the womb without a great deal of technological help. And the arguments now are whether the technology has gone far enough to allow it to survive from an earlier age. But why should the question of what technology can do be relevant to the question of whether an abortion should be allowed? You can't be arguing that this is somehow a natural state of viability if it's technologically dependent. It keeps going down because of the technology. So what's the idea? Now, supposing you were to have an abortion law which said, once the child is capable of living outside the womb, we could perhaps not abort the child but expel it from the womb so it was no longer incommoding the mother, and we'd keep it alive. That would be one kind of argument, but that isn't what's happening. They're saying somehow at the stage when we could by technology keep it alive, from that point on, we must insist that it stays alive inside the mother. I can think of no conceivable moral principle that makes any sense of that.
Are you saying we should just be honest that actually that debate doesn't really take you anywhere?
I'm saying that until you have decided why you think that debate takes you anywhere, you should not be engaging in that. That is, we should go back right down to the moral fundamentals. And the fact is, our current abortion law has no coherent moral underpinning at all. It's a kind of compromise outcome between people with radically different moral points of view, and neither of them is getting anything morally coherent. The point is, what our society has not done honestly is work out exactly what its principles are that the abortion law has been based on. And there are all kinds of possibilities. There's the idea that every human from the moment of conception has a right to life. That's the extreme anti-abortionist. There are the ones that say the mother should be able to get rid of the child right up to term. And then there's a kind of common sense view in the middle, which is that abortion gets more and more serious as the child develops. But it's still not clear what the nature of this seriousness is and how much it should be determined by what the interests of the mother are and so on. The fact is, this is just not thought through. What we're doing at the moment, arguing about these technological things and people rigging the evidence to suit their conclusions, we're actually avoiding the central issue and giving people the impression that it does turn on the scientific outcome. Now, once you've got the moral principles sorted out, then the scientific questions become relevant. If you can produce a moral principle to show why viability is relevant, then you can start asking about viability. But until you've got your principles clear, the science doesn't even arrive.
That was Janet Radcliffe-Richards of Oxford University. Andy, can I just bring you in quickly here? Some of the issues that Janet raised there about the fact that if you've got a certain ideology, you tend to sort of try and fix the scientific evidence to suit your opinions. And it's sort of, there's an amazing symmetry with debates around things like organic food and homeopathy and a lot of quackery, in fact. So, I mean, are we ever going to settle the science in those areas? Because that's what you're trying to do, and what Ben is trying to do with bad science, I suppose, is to tackle all of these things on the scientific level. But in fact, is that the wrong end of the debate? Or do we need to do it in a much more sort of personal attack way? Or
I don't know. It's a fascinating question. And you know, if I was honest, you know, I'm not really that interested in quackery, to be honest. Mm. But what I am interested in is the way people think, you know, and the way people get themselves into certain fixed ways of thinking. And I think in a lot of these debates, what you see is and I feel a bit silly talking about how brains work on the same program as Steven Pinker, but some people's emotional commitment to their beliefs and their wishes about the world are much stronger than their intellectual commitment to reason and evidence and science. And I've got no idea what the answer is, but as long as people in the world want to believe things more than they want to understand what's real about the world, then we're going to always have these debates.
I think fundamentally it's very, very uncomfortable when something that deep down inside some kind of belief or way you live your life, you know, perhaps it was something you learned when you were a child, or you know, you've forgotten why you know it or why you think it, is overturned by evidence. It's actually very uncomfortable.
Yeah, absolutely.
And some people, perhaps all of us, are not prepared to do that sometimes. You know, some issues some people are prepared to throw away and say, right, I'm going to go with the evidence, and others they're not.
The final Catherine wheel, though, has sputtered its final sparks, and the last rocket has whizzed its final trajectory for this show. My thanks to everyone in the pod, James Randerson, Ian Sample, and our guest, Andy Lewis, who I'm hoping we're going to see more often in the next few weeks. Remember that you can hear more of our conversation with Steven Pinker as this week's Science Extra, so head back to the blog or iTunes for more. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green, and I've been Alok Jha. We're going to leave you this week with a new tune from our friend, the Science Weekly troubadour, Johnny Berliner. This is his take on the history of human evolution. Enjoy.
A few billion years ago, the world had just begun. Some molecules said replicating gaily in the sun. And every day some cosmic rays would set their replicating all astray. So off they went to wend their way on the evolution of man and woman. And after a billion years that molecule had grown, mutated into RNA all upon its own. And soon it changed to DNA, then new bacteria and archaea. And I don't have a clue what they are in the evolution of man and woman. then we were unicellular beings in the sea. We fused ourselves with mitochondria to get energy. Evolving went from leaps to bounds, the greatest slime mold to be found in the multicellular and astounding evolution of man and woman. We soon evolved body shape and a simple one at that. Just a head and tail, we were wormy things and flat. We didn't have a backbone yet, we were still invertebrate. But soon a backbone's what we'd get in the evolution of man and woman. Now we had a skeleton, we'd swim with style and grace. But vegetation had turned the land to a green and lovely place. And since we were evolving still, we grew some legs and lost our gills. Amphibious life on land was brill in the evolution of man and woman. We became warm-blooded, so we grew ourselves some fur and scurried round like little mice, 'cause that's just what we were. But it was hard to grow some more, and that's because the dinosaurs would eat us up, and there'd be no more evolution of man and woman. One day a mighty meteor came down from the sky and killed those nasty dinosaurs so the mice and things could thrive. So everything mammalian grow bigger almost daily. And you just ask a paleontologist about the evolution of man and woman. Soon our furry ancestors were swinging in the trees, eating fruit and looking cute and swinging merrily. But swinging didn't work at all, so we started walking tall. Then we lost our fur and all in the evolution of man and woman. This is where our story starts a drawing to a close. We evolved a great big brain and started wearing clothes. And we'll evolve some more, I think, if we don't make ourselves extinct. And even though I've been succinct, that's the evolution of man and woman. Evolution of man.
Guardian Unlimited.